Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, December 9th. Just 5 days to go before the Electoral College is scheduled to vote, and the presidential election disputes have only now made it to the U.S. Supreme Court. This is what President Trump wanted. He retweeted a doctored photo someone created of Justice Amy Coney Barrett that looked like lasers were shooting out of her eyes. He tweeted that just yesterday. But last night, the court denied the lawsuit to throw out Pennsylvania's result. It was a terse one-line denial with no dissent noted. But it's not over yet. The Attorney General of Texas has filed a suit in which basically Texas asked the Supreme Court to throw out the election results in four other states. Of course, they are Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. The court has given the four state defendants until tomorrow afternoon to respond. We'll talk about that and more now with Susan Glasser, who writes the New Yorker magazine column called Letter from Trump's Washington. She will almost certainly have to rename the column next month, but the Supreme Court may yet have something to say about that. Susan is also the author, with her husband, New York Times Washington Bureau Chief Peter Baker, of the new book, or I should say White House Bureau Chief Peter Baker, of the new book, The Man Who Ran Washington, about former Treasury Secretary, Secretary of State, and Republican power lawyer in the Bush versus Gore post-election battles, James Baker. Susan, always a pleasure. Welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, thank you so much, Brian, for having me.
Now, wait, did I get Peter's title right the first time or the second time? Is he White House?
Any title's good as long as you mention the book. But he's the chief White House correspondent.
White House. Okay, I was right the second time. Sorry about that. What do you make of last night's Supreme Court decision and the fact that the Texas Attorney General filed an even bigger four-state Hail Mary just yesterday?
Well, look, I think it's as unequivocal as could be. It's the one sentence that should land like a bomb inside the White House. The fact that there's not even a single opinion, there's no dissent, there's no commentary. It's these lawsuits. The record is extraordinary. Essentially, they've gone 50 lawsuits filed and 50 defeated in this sort of vain and really disruptive attempt to attack the integrity of the election results. And, you know, the Supreme Court, Trump, you know, has been puffing it up, as you pointed out, even just hours before this, suggesting that somehow Amy Coney Barrett is going to repay his appointment of her to the Supreme Court with some kind of last-ditch ruling in his favor to swing the election to him. It just wasn't grounded in any sort of reality. And that overall has been the message from the judiciary, the federal judiciary and state courts since the election. It's been very, very clear cut that you can't just attack the election without any evidence and think that courts are going to throw out millions and millions of ballots.
What about this other suit from Texas? I mean, I personally think that it's not a coincidence that it was filed on the same day as the so-called safe harbor date, where states are supposed to certify their electors so they can vote in the Electoral College next Monday. I don't think it's a matter of delay and procrastination or they couldn't get it together. I think they filed it now on purpose to try to lob a bomb into the Electoral College vote scheduled for Monday.
Well, that is certainly possible. It's unequivocally much more, as one election lawyer put it, akin to a press release than an actual lawsuit. There is, as I understand it, less than zero chance of this lawsuit gaining any traction in the Supreme Court. The Constitution allows states to sue each other. Generally, this is a provision that is used for things like water rights or disputed boundaries between two states. The idea that one state, Texas, is going to tell other states how they should run their elections is literally preposterous. And it does seem in that sense that it is explicitly political. Your point is the timing towards the December 14th Electoral College meeting. It's also notable, of course, that yesterday was, under federal law, the National Safe Harbor Day. And that means that states, if they certified their election results by midnight. Essentially, they're unchallengeable. There's no grounds for overturning or changing the electoral results in those states if they complied with this federal law and made it by yesterday's safe harbor date. So the fact that Texas filed this lawsuit on that date, again, I agree with you. It seems like definitely not a coincidence.
If the firewall of democracy holds, should people be grateful and have a lot of respect for Republican elected officials at the state level and the judicial system, including judges and justices appointed by Trump, refusing to give up democracy even against their partisan interests?
You know, this has been the thing that I think I've really been wrestling with since the election, right, Brian? That it's a classic glass half full, glass half empty Trump era question. You know, these are folks like, for example, in Georgia, Republican Secretary of State, Republican Governor, Republican officials who voted for Donald Trump, who campaigned for him, who, you know, essentially signed off on, you know, many previous abuses of power. But when he came for them and their offices, it was too far. So on the one hand, unequivocally, that's given them a certain authority to speak out now. And it also has made it, I think, more clear, at least to some portion of the electorate, just how far outside the bounds of normal politics Trump has gone by attacking the election results. At the same time, you know, I had a conversation with Congressman Adam Schiff last week, who, of course, led the impeachment, which did not succeed in the Republican Senate. And I asked him this same question. And he said, look, you know, I welcome them belatedly to the fight. But, you know, there's nothing surprising about Trump and what he's doing, because, in fact, he said for months that he was going to attack the legitimacy of the election. And where were these people then, in effect? So it's a hard question. But look, it's a close call for our democracy. It does feel that we've blown through so many of the guardrails. It shouldn't come down to worrying about the safe harbor date. That's a procedural thing that shouldn't be invested with big political significance. It shouldn't come down to, remember a couple of weeks ago in the Wayne County Board of Electors, you know, that's not what we, Board of Canvassers, you know, we shouldn't be worrying about them as having the entire power of the national election after the fact in their hands.
Are you surprised that a lot of these state level Republicans are holding the line in the way that they are? I mean, if they all acted like Mitch McConnell, which is basically do anything you can to increase Republican power, then they would all be following the base passions, Republican base passions in their districts and in their states. And you wouldn't have Brian Kemp, the governor of Georgia, who up until now has been so pro-Trump, and some of these state legislative leaders in these states that are in play, legislative leaders who are Republican, holding the line. They could very easily, it seems to me, be enhancing their own political standing with their constituents who vote for them by subverting democracy.
Well, you're right. That's certainly one scenario. And again, that's what makes it such a close call for our democracy, because we're meant to depend and be a nation that has the rule of law and not of individual men and women, right? And so that's the great fear, is that we're now down to having a president who's willing to attack the laws. We're now down to individual men and women and relying upon them to do their jobs. And, you know, that's literally not how the system shouldn't have to come back to that final fail-safe moment. But I would point out that there is also arguably a moment where the political interests of at least some of these state and local officials do diverge from Donald Trump. Why is that? Well, because if you're a state elected official or a local election official, you know, you are essentially, if you agree with Donald Trump and national Republicans to throw out the votes in your state or your district, you're saying to your own voters, you know, essentially, never mind, right? You know, what you did was not valid. You know, and that's these appeals, for example, by Trump to state legislatures to overturn the will of the people as expressed by certified state election results. It's not necessarily in their political interest to do so, to say to their own state, never mind. And that's why you see some officials speaking out in a strong way.
There is a letter from Pennsylvania's State House of Representatives Majority Leader and other Republicans in the state asking Congress not to seat the state's Biden electors when that congressional vote to officially accept the Electoral College results, another thing that's just supposed to be a technicality, but now everybody's looking, oh, January 6th, what will Congress do after the Electoral College? At least one congressional Republican from Pennsylvania says he's ready to have that fight.
Yeah, I was really particularly struck by that as well, Brian. To have state legislature, who, by the way, followed the law when it came to their own actions, right? They didn't. They said, well, we don't have the ability as a state legislature to overturn the certification of our votes. But then to send what appears to be just a nakedly political letter that's not going to have any actual impact. It shows the sort of toxic power of this attack. It's like a probing attack in a way, right? Trump and those who are working with him are probing to see what are the potential weaknesses in our system. And I think one of the things that really has had me, sort of anxious up at night is think about if this election had actually been closer. What if these battleground states had not all broken for Biden? What if there were genuine evidence of fraud in one or two or three of these states? What, you know, you can sort of play this out, but imagine once they are finding the weaknesses in the system, what they would be able to do with either a more organized or legally competent group of attorneys or in a situation where there was actually something to go on.
If there was real fraud, then it should be found, though, right? And if these elections were close,
and
there was real fraud, then they should. Then it wouldn't even be a subversion of democracy. In that case, they should actually look into it and expose it.
Well, that's exactly right. But, you know, again, remember what happened in this situation where we actually did have a very close, essentially a too close to call national election in 2000. That raises a whole lot of issues that are not easily resolvable or clear cut, which is one of the reasons why people still have bruised feelings and argue about the 2000 recount in Florida to this very day. The striking thing about 2020 was that despite Trump's best efforts to do so, it just isn't an analogous situation. In 2000, basically, the entire presidential campaign came down to one state. It came down to Florida, and it came down to essentially a tie in Florida, a few hundred votes only, separating Al Gore and George Bush. Then you get into issues like, the way in which the voting was conducted, the hanging chads, and all of that, the kind of counting that occurred in various counties, the different standards that were in play. So you can call that fraud or not. There's just a lot of ambiguities and uncertainties that one can turn up in a process like that. But this is something completely different. The president of the United States is making a fantastical, unbelievable claim that literally millions of votes across multiple American states involving a conspiracy that includes the dead dictator of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, a voting machine company based in New York, Republican officials. It's literally a fantastical and absurdist claim.
And when Biden won Michigan by 150,000 votes, Pennsylvania by 80,000 plus votes, and so it's not close, which helps protect the outcome from party politics and petty politics. To your latest headline in The New Yorker, the president is acting crazy, so why are we shrugging it off? You know, sometimes I see the president in this phase as actually acting crazy, as like psychotic, saying he's won 2-0 in presidential races, all that stuff, 2-0, I should say, in presidential races, meaning he won them both. But sometimes I just see it as more of the same, offensive to most, but highly effective mobilizing of a big base that's now donating to him at an unbelievable rate to people who aren't doing it, just by being purposely outrageous in strategic ways. So crazy, Susan, or crazy like a fox?
Well, I think the crazy like a fox thing has been sort of pretty systematically debunked at this point. I mean, I don't actually subscribe to the idea that Trump is a master, you know, strategist of any sort. Obviously, he's being defeated over and over and over again in some ways, right? He's conducted a massive post-election campaign to have the federal judiciary resoundingly reject him and to confirm that he is a loser. Right? Every day brings new evidence of how much Donald Trump has lost. He's lost here. He's lost there. He's lost in this court. He's lost in this state again and again. So, but I did ask in the column this question, which continues, I think, to sort of haunt and perplex, which is, you know, think about that fantastical election conspiracy theory I just outlined. Either Donald Trump actually believes that, in which case it's just insane, or he is knowingly perpetrating, you know, the most direct, frontal, and cynical assault on our election system we've ever had from a president. And, you know, some people suggested after I wrote that, well, you know, maybe it's both. And, you know, we don't know what's inside his head. I don't think we need to. It is, factually speaking, a purposeful assault on the electoral integrity of our democracy. It seems pretty clear Trump is aware that he did not actually win. So what are his motivations? Is it about fundraising? Is it a scam? Is it a coup, an attempted coup? I think it can be both things.
And he's always had authoritarian dreams, and he never said he would leave office peacefully if he lost the election. He would never promise to reporters when they asked him a peaceful transition of power, because he would never accept a defeat as not a function of fraud. And, you know, Susan, there are armed protesters showing up in places now. And the Arizona Republican Party says, retweeted someone saying he's willing to die for the cause. Let me read this from the news site AZ Central, the Arizona news site. The Arizona Republican Party has asked its followers if they are willing to die for the cause of overturning the presidential election results, eliciting alarm and criticism from within and outside the GOP. The party's official Twitter account on Monday night shared a post from Ali Alexander, an activist with an organization called Stop the Steal that has protested election results. Alexander wrote, "I am willing to give my life for this fight. He is. Are you?" So, Susan, I'm speechless after reading that. Are you convinced there isn't going to be a guerrilla terrorist movement for Trump between now and January 20th?
Well, you know, I mean, look, that is one of the real risks here. And when you incite people, to this level of disaffection, you know, the poll numbers are absolutely stunning. There's such a partisan gulf between those, you know, Republicans who for the first time believe that somehow the election, was not honest, was not legitimate. The results were not real. I was speaking yesterday with someone who has great experience in counterterrorism at senior levels of government, mostly internationally, but who was saying that is, their biggest fear right now is the activization of, a heavily armed disaffected movement inside the United States. And, I think a lot of people are holding their breath and hoping that this does not take a violent turn. That's a great fear. And remember, over the summer, it seemed at times that Trump was almost inciting this kind of violence, even in the wake of the protests after the killing of George Floyd, that he seemed to want the United States to take its political divisions into the streets, and that somehow that would benefit him politically. So it's a very fraught moment, and I think you're right to raise this as a real fear.
And to the headline in your article, the president is acting crazy, so why are we shrugging it off? The shrugging it off part, you know, this Arizona story, it's one of those stories that I'm uncertain whether I should even mention it on the show, because it gives a wacko fringe undeserved publicity as if it was a serious position, dying for the cause of overturning this presidential election. But on the other hand, it needs journalistic scrutiny when it comes from an official source like that, the official Arizona Republican Party, not just some guy. So what do you think the role of responsible media is here?
You know, I think you're absolutely right to flag this as probably, you know, the signature media dilemma of the last few years, right? You're talking about a fringe position that shouldn't be given airtime. I mean, you know, that's literally how Donald Trump entered national politics. The original sin, if you will, of his public career was promoting the ridiculous birtherism conspiracy involving Barack Obama, right? And, you know, right now, I think it's very understandable, as I wrote, that the press, the media, is not wanting to give Trump's insane conspiracy theories about the election any more attention when it's pretty clear that the states have all certified their results and that the electoral college outcome on December 14th is not in doubt, right? So you could say, well, from a traditional news standpoint, therefore, you know, there's no real news value in the president attacking the outcome of the election with these lawsuits because they're not going to succeed. There's no scenario by which it can succeed. But of course, the allegations themselves have a reality, and especially because they're amplified in the loud fringe pro-Trump media space. And so I think, you know, I guess what I've seen the last few years has convinced me that we have to be able to look at what Trump is doing squarely in the eye, right? And to really understand what are the consequences of this and just saying, well, we don't like this or, you know, it's not true, so we're not going to publicize it. You know, unfortunately, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And I think that, you know, the political consequences are obvious. Look at these numbers of what is happening to Republicans' faith in democracy as a result of the purposeful attack on it that the president is launching.
Mike in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm just curious as to why we're not looking more into the situation of possible treason charges against Trump and Giuliani and the Texas senator and the other people that are involved in this attempted coup. In other countries, you know, this would be commonly something that would be done by the party that won. We need to figure this out. How is there treason here being perpetuated by Trump and his cronies?
I understand why you would feel that way. But, Susan, it could be, and, you know, I could field calls like that for the next 20 minutes if I wanted to. But treason is a specific thing that has to do with helping a foreign enemy of the country. And Trump, no matter what we think of these things, does have a right to go to court over and over until the process is completed.
Well, that's exactly right. It's if he were to start taking extra legal measures, you know, that then it would pose an even different threat to the system. You know, he can raise money making false claims. That's what he's been doing all along. After all, you know, his free speech enables him to say, as he's tweeting even now while we're having this conversation, ridiculous claims. They should be hopefully labeled and contextualized as such. There is a robust debate already breaking out, as of course you know, among Democrats as to whether, you know, the new Biden administration should continue with potential prosecutions of Trump. There's, of course, the opening question of whether he will seek to pardon himself, which would be an unprecedented use of the presidential pardon power, and whether that would be legal or legitimate. But, you know, I think we're going to hear a lot of debate and dispute for many months after Trump is out of the White House on, you know, what, if anything, should be the right approach from prosecutors. The American tradition up until now has been that the president himself, you know, should not be subjected to what people could see as a form of victor's justice, that was part of what distinguished the U.S. and its democracy from other places like Ukraine, where, you know, as you know, Trump was impeached over his dealings with Ukraine. You know, in Ukraine, just a few years ago, there was a very controversial effort, and the U.S. was strongly critical of, you know, the incoming president trying to prosecute and imprison his defeated opponent, Yulia Tymoshenko. And so do we really want to be that kind of country? Gerry Ford pardoned Richard Nixon. He probably lost his own presidential bid because of it. But I think many historians, many Democrats and Republicans have ultimately concluded that that was the right decision.
So in our last 30 seconds, what happens to your column next month, which is titled Letter from Trump's Washington? Do you just make it Letter from Biden's Washington, or are you considering it sort of bad luck to rename a column before anything is official?
Well, I think it's fair to say, Ryan, we have not, you know, come to a final decision. Do you have a preference? What's your vote? Do we just delete the Trumps or do we add in Biden's? What do you think?
I would not presume to get in the middle of your meeting with David Remnick and say what the New Yorker should do. But I'm sure it'll be good, whatever it is. And we'll keep having you on the show, even when it's Biden's Washington. Susan Glasser, thank you as always.
Thank you, Brian. Great to be with you and all your wonderful listeners.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.